performance by Cliff Lee.
Victorino in the alley calling. He's got it! And the Phillies are going back to the World Series!
Welcome to a special Saturday morning edition of Continued Success. Frankly, it doesn't matter which of the podcasts this is from the Good Fight Podcast Network. This is a Saturday morning podcast from the Good Fight Podcast Network with Justin Clue, me, the head guy at the Good Fight, and John Stolness, also of the Good Fight. And honestly, we had so much to say about last night that we had to just get on a podcast and talk about it this morning. And maybe we'll throw in a little 2009 Phillies anecdotes at the end just to make ourselves feel better. But that's the plan today. John, how are you feeling after the Phillies 19-11 loss to the Marlins last night?
I couldn't wait, Justin. I couldn't wait. I woke Amy up early this morning, my wife, and said, I get to go on and do a podcast this morning. We get to talk about 19-11. We get to talk about the Phillies and the Marlins. I can't believe it. I can't believe there's only one game we get to talk about.
Your eyes snapped open. Big Disney princess, wet eyes snapped open this morning, and you just woke up your wife saying, today's the day.
Yeah.
Today's the day. They blew a 7-run lead.
I can't believe it. To the worst team in baseball. I was very excited. Very excited.
Well, honestly, before we dive into that, I'm going to take a real sharp left turn and do something I've been meaning to do, and that is just bring up real quick that it's not all bad. There are still good vibes out there in the universe, and you can find them at the third annual Puppapalooza at the Pier from the PSPCA, a Phillies-themed event on Thursday, August 29th. Scott Kingery is going to be there. Yay, everyone loves Phillies
Scott,
players.
Yeah.
It'll be from 6 to 9 p.m. at Morgan's Pier. Everyone knows where that is on Columbus Boulevard. Last year, they had guest bartenders Reese Hoskins and Reese Hoskins' dog.
Hang on. Reese Hoskins' dog was making people drinks?
Which, that's got to be a health code violation
of
some kind. Aaron Nolan, Roman Quinn were all there last year. And the Philly Fanatic will obviously be making an appearance. And they've got all kinds of stuff going on. So I wanted to be sure to mention that because it's a cool event. It's a great event. It's an important event for the city. And I like mentioning when the Phillies are doing things like that that overlap with good things for the city. Unfortunately, they weren't doing a lot of good things for baseball last night. So let's just rewind back a couple of days, actually, John. So the Phillies win two games against the Red Sox in Boston, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they take two games from the Red Sox. And one thing I noticed after that was that, everyone was feeling good, and you should be feeling good. Red Sox, haven't been as good, much like the Phillies. The Red Sox haven't been as good as everyone, I think, imagined. They've been something of a letdown in the second half, and still a team that you got to be able to beat. Still a good team. Still a team you wouldn't necessarily think the Phillies could beat. But one thing I noticed was that people were very quick to say, especially the Phillies Twitter account, Phillies, they swept. They swept the Red Sox. It was a sweep. They swept them. Oh, they swept out the Red Sox in their own stadium. And I just had to keep going back and confirming that it was just a two-game set. Which, hey, look, winning one more game in Boston, it's like, okay, what difference does that make? And you're right. But at the same time, I mean, it just seemed like people were in a very, very big hurry, which is understandable, but a very big hurry to proclaim this a magnificent, unbelievable feat by the Phillies. And hey, look, they were two great wins, really two really good wins that it was good to see, that were done in the way that we want to see this Phillies team winning games. It was easy to feel good. And we're running out of chances for this team to use events as like that pivot towards being good or going on that run that we keep talking about. And that was a perfectly, yes, that could have been it as well. So they turn around with the Marlins, three games against the Marlins, looking them in the face. And we all kind of thought the same thing. I think we all kind of thought, they beat the Red Sox. I think Jim Salisbury, who I'm going to quote again later in the podcast, but I think Jim Salisbury is the one who said if they lost a series to the Marlins now, it would be like drowning in the bathtub after swimming the English Channel.
Right.
And that was, that's exactly right. So after that Red Sox series, John, how were you feeling heading into a series with the Marlins?
Well, I mean, I was expecting more. I mean, I left that Boston series thinking, okay, you had your pitching shut down the best offense in baseball. And whatever the Red Sox have going on with them, it's all in their pitching. Their pitching has fallen apart, in much the same way the Phillies' pitching has fallen apart this year. But the Red Sox are still averaging over 5 runs a game. They're averaging over 5 runs a game this year. And so I think that's the third best runs per game in baseball they have. And so when the Phillies pitching shut them down, I thought, well, okay, you know, it probably is just a little bit of a two-game fluke here. But Aaron Nola pitched one of those games. So that accounted for one of the good pitching performances. And in the other game, the bullpen stepped up when Drew Smyly had to leave early. So by no means did I feel like, okay, we've gotten everything figured out now. But the expectation was certainly there on my part that, okay, if you think you're a playoff team and you think you're going to be able to make it into October, into the October tournament, you got to beat the Marlins and the Pirates after this series. And I, you know, at some point you got to start sweeping some folks, you know, if you're going to make up ground. And so I didn't feel, I mean, I thought it was a good springboard. I thought it was good that the Phillies had finally gotten a little bit of momentum. They had won 6 out of 8 coming into this series against the Marlins. But man, we've seen this team against the Marlins this year. I by no means felt like it was a sure thing that this team was going to go ahead and sweep this team.
Oh, there are no sure things with this team.
No.
And I think that's the only thing you can be assured of at this point in the season. And, you know, we're talking about a lot of guys who, I mean, we're all looking for promise in some players, where especially the most vulnerable points on the Phillies roster. We're all looking for improvements. But now it's late August. You know, there's what, like 5 weeks left in the season. And it's just kind of like, if you're a player who's never really been that effective, and here we are in 2019 when the Phillies were supposed to have turned the corner and made all these signings and begun this next good era of Phillies baseball, and you are still that same player for the first 5 months of the baseball season, and even if now you just find another gear and become good, that's 1 month out of dozens of months,
right,
where you figured it out. And it's just, it doesn't mean you're a good player. It means you're probably a pretty bad player. And we're going to, you know, I don't want to beat anybody over the head specifically with blame. Actually, yes, I do. We're going to do exactly that.
Let's play.
Last night, you know, playing the Marlins, the Phillies had a disastrous bottom of the third.
A dirty inning, one could say, Justin.
Yeah, and I can't wait to break down how exactly we're going to address
in,
that.
In 10 years, when you break down this game.
When they have them in real time, it is always very surreal.
Yeah, exactly.
We're watching history happen right before our eyes. they had a disastrous bottom of the third. Vince Velasquez gave up like 20 singles and a home run. There were two hit batsmen. Juan Nicasio left the game after one batter with an injury. And then the Phillies gave up 13 more runs after that, after starting the game with a 7-0 lead. And I think we can all agree, John, that none of this would have happened if Bryce Harper hadn't been on paternity leave.
Yeah. No, I blame the new baby for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and anyone who isn't blaming the new baby is not a real Philadelphia sports fan.
Honestly.
I mean, let's just lay it all out there. I don't know what this new baby's name is, but no one can ever name their child whatever name the Harpers give their child, because it'll be a cursed name, and we're going to have to avoid it.
I hope it's Vince.
That's right. Wouldn't that be funny? There's no, I mean, listen, I know, I think Bryce Harper will actually escape criticism here, because,
yeah.
first of all, he's been so good lately, and he's the $330 million man, and everybody loves Harper, with the exception of the few idiots who yell overrated at him at baseball games, and then he has to scream F you at them as he's walking off the field. But, you know, Bryce Harper's been so good. But again, when you're facing the Marlins, this is the perfect time for him to take paternity leave, when you have a team like the Marlins in front of you. The Phillies are still 10 times more talented than this Miami team, even without Bryce Harper. They still have JT Realmuto, and they still have Reese Hoskins and Gene Segura and Scott Kingery, and you went out and you got Corey Dickerson for a reason. And so you have a lineup that should still be deep enough. You had to bring Michael Franco back up from AAA to replace him in the lineup, and Franco had a key hit when the Phillies were trying to come back after losing that 7-0 lead. But he also made a couple of bad defensive plays last night. So again, there's the good and the bad with Michael Franco, but you bring him up when Harper leaves, and he didn't cost you the game last night, but it's certainly not, you know, Bryce Harper gets to take paternity leave, and it would be great if he could be away and be with his family longer than just a couple of days. But my guess is after last night, he's going to try and get back as quickly as possible. I feel
I should have been there
to do that, but
I could have done something.
and Bryce, no, you couldn't. I mean, because Vince Velasquez was in control of things last night. But yeah, you're right, man. And I think there probably will be some people who yell at the baby and yell at Bryce Harper for having for reproducing, but they shouldn't because this Phillies team is certainly good enough to beat the Marlins. They're good enough to sweep this team without Bryce Harper in the lineup. It's that simple. There's no excuses.
Yes, that's absolutely true. They should at least be able to outpace them on the offensive side of things. But as we saw last night, I mean, this is the same story. This is and the reason I think we've had so many chances to latch on to a good Phillies game as a potential turning point for the season is because Aaron Nola is in the rotation. Mm-hmm. You get an Aaron Nola start and then one of the other guys manages to go six innings or something. You probably have like two solid games in a row. But then the rest of it, it's just the same thing it's always been. The rest of the rotation is just ribbons, just bags of sand. Yeah. And you're not going to win too many games in a row with a rotation like that. And I know you'll still find Vince Velasquez defenders out there. And again, I'm a Vince Velasquez fan. I think he's that game, the 15-inning game where he played in the outfield, maybe reminded me what a awesome
he's
baseball
a phenomenal
player
athlete.
He is.
I mean, he's a phenomenal athlete. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it.
That play where he got hit on the arm and then threw with his other arm last year. It's awesome. These are reasons to watch baseball. But unfortunately, on the pitching mound, he just can't get it done. And being one of the Phillies' best pitchers isn't really an award-winning accolade at the moment. It's just saying, okay, so you've of the guys giving up runs and not going deep into games, you have done that a little less lately.
Yeah, and, like who are we comparing you to here? I mean, let's because I
Nick
got
Pivetta. Anyone?
Yeah, and Zach Eflin with the heavy body and Drew Smiley. I mean, who after for the first two starts where people were throwing Cliff Lee comparisons around has been terrible. I mean, yeah, when you say Vince Velasquez has been the second best pitcher on this team for the last month. Well, let's take two things into consideration here. First, second best pitcher on this team is not a high bar to hurdle. That doesn't make you a good pitcher. That doesn't make you worth rostering if you're a team with playoff aspirations. Second, a month. The last month. That's all we're looking at here? We're just going to look at the last month? I agree that, you know, you shouldn't only look at 162-game samples when you're making a judgment on a player. Sometimes you have to look at a smaller sample size. But if you're making an overall judgment of Vince Velasquez, we've seen him do this before. We've seen him implode like this after getting big leads. We know, I mean, everybody was ready to drum him out of the rotation earlier in the season. He's only in the rotation because the Phillies are desperate and they don't have anyone else to put in there. They obviously don't like anyone that they have in AAA. They obviously don't feel good about Drew Anderson or Eniel De Los Santos to give them a shot in the major league rotation. So here's Vince. And, you know, Vince is still chasing that 16 strikeout game from his second game with the team, and it's never going to happen. The guy cannot give you more than five innings, and if he on those rare blue moons when he does go past the fifth inning, you're just waiting for the ceiling to cave in. I don't want a guy. I mean, I'm just done with that. We should expect more. I think that's the thing is people don't feel like they should expect more from a starting pitcher on a team with playoff aspirations. And we should expect more than what Vince Velasquez gives us. So don't come at me with that noise about Vince Velasquez being their second best pitcher this year. Don't give me the noise about, well, this year he's got a 4.23 ERA. Well, first of all, that's not great. Second of all, it's not 4.23 anymore. It's 4.93.
Since becoming a starting pitcher again on June 16th, Vince Velasquez has made 10 starts. He has gone past the fifth inning in three of those starts, and he has gone past the sixth inning in one start.
I mean, what are we praising here? What are we holding on to? I realize there's no other option right now. Mm-hmm. I get that, you know, because they don't have any confidence in a
but they put
a
themselves
guy.
In this position right. as well. Like, I right. mean, yeah, there's only so much you can do. But in the middle of the season, I mean, we've been saying it since probably, well, some of us have been saying it forever. The trade deadline, this kind of reached, you know, higher volume. But mm-hmm. there should have been more pitching moves made in January, even if they were similar to the moves the Phillies made in July.
Yeah.
At least you would have known a little more about what you had earlier in the season than trying to convince people Drew Smiley was Cliff Lee in early August.
Right.
So, yeah, that's kind of the position the Phillies have found themselves in. And also, all these young pitchers we're talking about are guys who've been with the organization for, like, what, half a decade now?
Yeah.
So we do know them.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, we can't exclusively talk about last night's poor pitching outcomes. and not talk about Nick Pivetta, who came in after Juan Nicasio left after facing a batter, giving up a hit, leaving with an injury. And Nick Pivetta did pretty much what Nick Pivetta's forte is right now. It was a signature Nick Pivetta performance. He was in there to eat some innings, and he ate 2 1/3 innings. Well, I guess he wasn't in there to eat innings because they'd only tied the game.
Yeah.
They'd given up 7 runs, and it was still a tie game.
Well, and they're up 9-7 with him. That's in the game.
Right.
They needed him. They needed him to hold down the fort. They gave Nick Pivetta a lead.
Why did they do that?
I guess they thought Nick Pivetta here in this stage, they did want to get multiple innings out of him and try and get him through. I think they probably wanted him to try and get them through the third, fourth, and fifth innings so that you can get to the
sure. But why did you think he could do that? It's like, oh, the light bulb's out. Better try to screw this pencil sharpener back into the thing and make sure it's not working and it's still dark in here. What happened?
I guess their only options are guys for guys who can give you multiple innings. It's the converted starters that you have in the bullpen. And none of those guys are doing well. I mean, Ranger Suarez until last night had been pitching pretty well in the bullpen, but not for length. He'd been pretty good for an inning here and there. And they asked Ranger Suarez to try and give them 2 or 3 innings last night. And eventually that caught up with him. But Pivetta was, I mean, only one of the runs Pivetta gave up was earned. Four of the runs were unearned. And yet his ERA is still 5.38 this season.
Yes.
But I mean, at some point you've got it, you know, a guy behind you makes an error. Okay, you got to button it down. And he doesn't do that. He implodes when things go wrong.
He
starts throwing stuff right down the middle of the plate. And, you know, like you said, I think when we had our last hitting season podcast, he's not good enough to do that. He's not a 99-mile-an-hour guy. He can't throw stuff right down the middle. And I thought when he went to the bullpen, his stuff would play up better because he's only pitching 1 or 2 innings here and there. It hasn't. It's the same stuff, which is a big worry for me. You know, I was kind of the same thing with Velasquez when he went to the bullpen. The stuff didn't play up any differently. It was the same stuff. You were just hoping to see it for less, you know, less amount of time. And so with Pivetta and Velasquez, they were depending so much on both of these guys. And again, I mentioned this on a previous podcast. I think I wrote about it for The Good Fight. If you're looking for a reason why this team failed this year, Velasquez, Pivetta, Eflin are the chief reasons why.
Yeah, and it's tough to argue. I mean, and that's what makes it so funny to talk about games like this where it's just the same thing happened, and not even just the same thing from 2019. The same thing we've been kind of watching for years now. And, you know, it's hindsight's 2020 and all that. And I think the reality of it is that this was just a really, really crappy game. The Marlins scored their first run on a bases-loaded hit-by-pitch, which is the, you know, surest sign that a dirty inning is incoming when you're when you're hitting a guy to score a run with no outs. That's that's coming. And the Phillies actually walked twice with the bases loaded in the top of the ninth. They're already down by 9 runs at that point, so it wasn't really going to make a difference. But they did do that twice. They did no other offense, they did do that.
And when you think, I mean, the Marlins didn't come into this game playing well, and they had lost 6 straight, and they had lost 16 out of 19. In the 6-game losing streak, they'd scored 13 runs in their 6-game losing streak and then put up 19 on the Phillies last night.
The Phillies are a slump. They're a slump buster. You know,
I
said this when the, I think it was the Giants, when Will Smith hit a single against the Giants, and I think it was probably the last time we were really upset on the podcast when he hit his first major league hit after, you know, many years in the major leagues off Nick Pivetta, I believe, and knocked in a pair of runs when the Phillies were playing the Giants. And I said, boy, you know what? At least other teams seem like they enjoy playing the Phillies because there's just there's no better team to play when you're just trying to get out of a funk, when you want to see something you've never seen before, when you want to overcome a lead. The Phillies hadn't blown a 7-run lead in 16 years. Mm-hmm. So when you want to see something historical, you play the Phillies.
There was one other stat that I saw that had a lot to do with history. I'm pulling it up, the Phillies led 7-0. The Phillies had not lost a game by 6 or more runs in which they once led by 7 or more runs at any point since 1908. Like, this is the first time the Phillies had a 7-run lead, blew it, and then lost by at least 6 runs ever. So, there's a little history for you. When you're dirty inning this thing in about a decade here, buddy, I'll keep this stat favorited in my tweet and my timeline for you.
Well, one thing, there's a couple more things I want to talk about in regards to this game. I'm not quite done yet. So we're going to take our first break, and then we're going to come back and keep talking about how stupid this loss was right after this. Well, John, we're talking about the Phillies' desperately pathetic 19-11 loss to the Marlins last night. We're casting a lot of blame here, and I think it's totally fair to talk about Vince Velasquez not being good enough and Nick Pivetta not being good enough. And yeah, there's a lot of little X factors to explore, but for the most part, we've seen enough of a lot of these pitchers, and it's time in our minds, you know, if you could just hit a button and move on and experiment with other pitchers, obviously you would do that. But at this point in the season, you know, with these guys having the, in the situations they are, obviously things don't work exactly like that. So, you know, people have been looking for people to blame all season long. And I know we just pretty much agreed that one of the biggest reasons the Phillies aren't the Phillies we hope to see was because of guys like Zach Eflin, Nick Pivetta, Vince Velasquez, just never finding their way on the pitching mound. People have been blaming Gabe Kapler all season long for any matter of issues. Corey Simon talked about earlier this week about how a guy called into WIP and, quote, spent 5 minutes hammering Gabe Kapler, who is a manager, not a GM, for signing Carlos Santana last season and keeping Cesar Hernandez around. So, yeah, people might be a little misguided when it comes to who exactly is to blame for what. But I don't know. I've also seen the sentiment. I mean, I am of the mind that Gabe Kapler has certainly earned more than his share of blame this season. I've found a lot of his decisions to be questionable. I've found his reasons for some decisions to be illogical or nonsensical. But I know there's still some ardent Gabe Kapler defenders out there, and they were out last night, and they were saying that he didn't lose that game, and that he is 100% faultless for last night's loss. And I was wondering if you agree with that sentiment.
I mean, he's in a tough spot. Mm-hmm. I get it. He doesn't have the pitching that you would want your big league manager to have. And when your pitchers come through for you, you can look a lot smarter. I mean, in the Boston series, he made some decisions, probably in other series, that would have backfired on him. When he took Aaron Nola out after seven innings, there is every reason to believe that Mike Morin and Jose Alvarez don't hold that one run lead, you know, and that maybe Aaron Nola, if you push him to like 120 pitches, gets you through the eighth inning. And if the Phillies had blown that lead in Boston by pulling Aaron Nola, there would have been a segment of the fan base that would have criticized him. And I thought at the time that he should have left Nola in, and it worked out. And so you escape criticism when your players come through for you. It's really, I mean, you could argue that he should have taken Vince Velasquez out earlier than he did, but I think the idea there is you're trusting your starting pitcher who, again, if we're going to say he has been the team's second best starting pitcher over the last month, I'll grant you that, because maybe I think Jason Vargas maybe have been a little bit better than Vince Velasquez. But either way, it's apples and apples, you know. So if you're trying to get if you believe Vince Velasquez has been on a pretty good roll lately, OK, he gives up a few runs in the third inning. Maybe it gets to 7-4. Well, we've seen Aaron Nola do that. And then lock it down. You know what I mean? We've seen pitchers give up a few runs after getting a big lead and then lock it down. But Velasquez imploded, and by that point, after the 3-run home run that tied the game up, it's too late to do anything. And now your options are, okay, I've had to pull Vince in the third inning. What do I do now? With a rested bullpen, but it's too early in the game to start bringing in Hector Neris and Blake Parker and Jose Alvarez, these guys that you need to get you through the end of the game. And you do need a pitcher that can give you multiple innings at this point. You know, so you're looking out in the bullpen. Okay, who am I going to here? Well, I've basically got two guys that can give me length, the Ranger Suarez and Nick Pivetta. All right, Nick, let's give it a shot. You know what I mean? I think that's kind of where he's at. So, yeah, you could have pulled Velasquez earlier, but if you pull Velasquez earlier, who are you bringing in? You're probably bringing in Nick Pivetta. So, I mean, I don't know at this point. I mean, I think Gabe Kapler has done a lot of things that I disagree with this year with bullpen management, and there's some moves and some lineups that I don't understand. And I think a lot of times they don't use analytics and the information the correct way. I don't think they're always looking at the right stuff. Last night, man, the pitchers have to hold a 7-run lead. Yeah. And when the team goes back up by two runs, the pitchers have to bear down in that case. So I'm as open to criticizing Gabe Kapler as anybody else, but for last night, for me the blame falls on the pitchers and talking more about the pitching, I'm really wondering how secured Chris Young's job is, cuz I don't see a single pitcher, a single one, that's gotten better under Chris Young. Not one. And I know Gabe Kapler will tell you, well, it's not linear. These guys don't get better. You know, there's not benchmarks that they pass, you know, like you're going through checkpoints in an auto race. You know what I mean? But at some point, you got to be able to point to one or two guys and say, yeah, this guy's been better this year. They figured something out.
At some point, you got to be able to look at it from a broad view and not the super scrutinized or even just a little scrutinized statistical view. You got to be able to look at it and say, like, there's good pitchers on this team, because there's just not. There's just not a lot of good pitchers on this team.
And too often, I think, you know, I Gabe Kapler was, before Bryce got here, was the face of the franchise. And in a lot of ways, he still is. But it's a lot easier to criticize the manager than it is to sometimes the players have to step up.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta protect a 7-0 lead.
Yes.
You just have to. I don't care. That's not on the manager last night. The players have to protect the 7-0 lead. I'm mad at the players this morning. I'm not mad at Kapler. At some point, you got to nut up as a player and protect a 7-run lead against a team that had lost, what did I say, 16 out of 19 and six in a row? No, you can't do that.
Unless you're interested in the grim statistics that a game like that generates, there's really nothing to read or say in a game recap about that game. Because you're right, it comes down to, I agree with you, it comes down to simply the players have to be good enough to win that game. And you shouldn't have to be that good to win a game stake to a 7-0 lead. I mean, yeah, we can talk about whose fault it was and break it down, but if we're doing blame pie charts after every game, then that kind of tells you this team's really not in a great spot anyway.
Right.
Like, yeah, that loss last night wasn't Gabe Kapler's fault, but a couple of losses this year have been. And,
yeah,
and
totally
overall
fair.
Culture of the team, which, you know, is what it is. Who knows what it is? But like the environment in which these guys operate, that's on him too. I mean, there's things that are Gabe Kapler's fault.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess I'll put on a tinfoil hat here a little bit. But like when you compare the image Gabe Kapler had last year, and yeah, you're always going to have guys calling into WIP with misguided notions of what Gabe Kapler's job actually is or what analytics actually are. But you know, I think this year it's a lot more gentle on Gabe Kapler. Part of that is the Phillies signed Bryce Harper, and focus has been elsewhere. And I agree. I think he's not really the face of the franchise anymore, but he is the lightning rod of the franchise.
Oh, yeah.
But that being said, I feel like maybe he hired a PR specialist or has a bunch of burner accounts, because there is like a squad of people who posts up ready to tell you why nothing in the world is Gabe Kapler's fault anymore.
Sure.
And it's yeah, I know that's just like the way fandom works anymore. Something happens in a baseball game and everybody gets in their corners and gets ready to scream at each other about whose fault it definitely is or definitely isn't. But yeah, I
here's
feel like
the thing. Here's the thing. It can be more than one person's
it
fault.
Definitely can and has been. I mean, we talk about Vince Velasquez being like the second best pitcher on this team. Every team has a second best pitcher.
Right.
Every team. And most teams are very bad. So, like, yeah, that's not really a great qualification.
No, and I would even say, if you're talking about somebody like Vince Velasquez right now, if you're looking at a playoff team, most teams' fourth and fifth starters are better than Vince Velasquez.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, the Phillies had to acquire Jason Vargas, the Mets' worst pitcher, to improve their rotation. So, yeah, don't tell me that somebody being the best or second best pitcher on the Phillies is a great, you know, that's a resume builder. But I agree. I mean, I think part of my conspiracy theory is that it's become, for whatever reason, maybe people are just thinking a little harder. Maybe we're all just looking for a fresh take on Phillies disappointing us. But it's become a lot more trendy to blame Matt Klentak than it has been to blame Gabe Kapler. And there's no reason for that. I mean, when you talk about, well, Gabe Kapler can only do what he can with the players he has, who gave him those players? Well, Matt Klentak. Matt Klentak was doing the job that the guy who called in WIP thought Gabe Kapler was doing.
Right.
So, I mean, loss last night, you can't, you know, blaming the GM for every loss is, I guess, you know, you could do that if you wanted to. But mostly I think the blame falls upward to Matt Klentak when it's a game where it's like, well, the Phillies should have won. They just didn't have the resources. They didn't have the firepower. They weren't equipped to win a 7-0 game. And that, I think, does, you can more easily blame Matt Klentak for a loss like that. I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Matt Klentak deserves his share of blame here. And I think it was reasonable to assume that one or two of the young starters that we've been talking about so much would step up. I thought Nick Pivetta would have a good year this year. I really did. I was in that crowd. I thought everything, and you know, I was reading a Jeff Passan piece from the offseason, and a lot of major league teams, he said, were asking for Nick Pivetta in trades because they were intrigued by all of the you know, the spin rate stuff that hitters that pitching coaches salivate over. And I'll bet you if Nick Pivetta went to the Astros, they'd turn him into a good pitcher. I just think some teams are able to work with guys better than others. But I think Matt Klentak certainly entered the season doing a lot. He put a core together, but he didn't fill in the gaps in that core, you know. And we all said that they should have gotten a starting pitcher. I maintain, and you remember this. I was willing to give Corbin a 6-year deal because I thought in the first few years he'd be worth it. And he's been outstanding for the Nationals this year.
Man, when we were debating over how long the Phillies should sign Patrick Corbin, and then decided when he went somewhere else, it's fine. Yeah, you know, we'll do that. Man, what a luxury!
I was not happy about that. I wanted to give him 6 years, and I knew that the last two would probably be bad. But you know, for the first 4 years of that deal, I was all in on Patrick Corbin being on this team. But I was also in on them getting Charlie Morton. I would have given Charlie Morton 3 years, and he took a 2-year deal to go pitch for the Astros. And maybe he just wanted to go. Or no, it was the Rays. And maybe he just wanted to go play for Tampa in front of 25 fans every night. But I mean, he didn't like his time in Philadelphia when he was here. Maybe, I don't know. But
yeah, I don't know how many Rays podcasts there are for you to get lambasted.
Yeah, you can probably land softly there. But you know, I think the Phillies expected the bullpen to carry through any gaps that the starting rotation had this year, and Matt Klentak relied on a mix of the veterans that he'd signed in free agency with some of the young, exciting arms in that the Phillies had. I mean, they expected Sir Anthony Dominguez to take a step forward this year when he's been hurt all year and wasn't that good before he got hurt. I think they expected Edgar Garcia to make an impact in the bullpen, and he was terrible in the time that he was here. Eddie Ramos and Victor Arano, they expected to take a step forward this year because they showed promise last year. None of them have. And then all of the veterans that you got to kind of back up that youth, they all got hurt too. And so, I mean, it's not like the Phillies put all of their eggs in the veteran reliever basket. They tried to mix and match, and they tried to go out and get a guy in Robertson who was reliable and dependable and doesn't get hurt. And you end up going to get 7 outings from him during the course of his 2-year contract. There's a fair amount of bad luck when it comes to the bullpen, but that's where the strategy of Matt Klentak fell apart. We're not going to do anything with the rotation because we feel like we have a bullpen that can stem the tide if some of these pitchers, some of these starters don't come through. And it all blew up.
And I think if you're going on a game-by-game basis, I think I'm going to land on this, that there has been a litany of issues of blame to go around this season. And I think you could probably go back through the game logs and just pick a game to blame Gabe Kapler for, pick a bunch of games to blame Matt Klentak for, pick a bunch of games to blame the offense for. And last night was a game where you can blame the pitching and you can specifically blame Vince Velasquez. Because, yeah, frankly, you look at the box score, it's not that hard. You don't got to break this one down too much. Mm-hmm. It's a 7-run lead. Yeah. You have a 7-run lead in the third inning, you win that ball game.
Yep.
If you are worth a damn, if you are playoff bound, you win that ball game. And it's not especially difficult. The Phillies blew it. And then they gave up almost 20 runs. So kind of tells you where they are.
Yeah, as I'm looking at the... As I'm looking on Fangraphs at the win probability for this game, at one point the Phillies were at 7-0, they were at 98.6 to win the game. 98.6% chance of winning the game. I've seen some statistics that lead me to believe that it is high. Yes.
Well, I mean. I think we probably kind of have inadvertently covered the answer to this question already, but we're going to go down this road anyway. So, John, after last night, everybody seemed like they were down on this team. I mean, there's people who've been down on this team since April. There's people for whom, you know, maybe it was Kutch's injury. They decided they were down on this team. For me, it was that 15-inning game, as I've said, that I really fell down on this team. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean we're incapable of being excited about them anymore. It's just like, boy, your fandom for the 2019 Phillies just kind of maybe went down a few rungs, and it feels irrecoverable at this point. But it feels like last night was another one of those nights, another milestone in the season, whatever the negative version of a milestone is. Everybody seemed like they were down on this team, and I don't mean just the fans. Tom McCarthy sounded like he was doing play-by-play at a funeral by the end of this game.
Yeah.
Jim Salisbury called it an insult to baseball and was particularly seemed particularly vicious just on Twitter following this game specifically. Matt Breen of the Inquirer called it the worst loss of the Phillies' season, and he was the one I saw who pointed out that the team hadn't blown a 7-run lead in 16 years. So the press was not holding back in how bad this game was. So, John, at this point, you know, we talked about how we were feeling after the Red Sox sweep and going into this series against a last place team. Cautiously, ever so cautiously optimistic. Then this game happens. How does this make you feel about the rest of the Phillies season? Where are you on the Phillies right now? Are you excited to turn on the game tonight?
No. No, I have zero confidence in this baseball team. We've seen a lot of different kinds of losses this year. We've seen crushing losses. We've seen disappointing losses, infuriating losses, and we've seen boring losses where they just don't show up. This one was disgusting. Mm-hmm. This was a disgusting, revolting loss that the Phillies suffered last night. And it just leads me to believe they don't have it in them to win enough games to get to the postseason. They don't deserve a postseason spot.
Yeah.
These six games, and there's five more left, and maybe they win five in a row for the first time this year, and we're singing a different tune next week, but these six games against these two bad teams, the Phillies have been talking about, oh, when we get on a roll, we just need to get on a roll. This is where you get on a roll. This is where you put together the long winning streak. You take those two Boston wins, and you win five out of six, or heaven forbid, all six games against two of the worst teams in baseball. I know no one's ever won six in a row before, but I thought maybe we could give it a shot. You win all six of those games, and now you're legitimately on a roll for the first time this year. And maybe you make a believer out of me, but no, I'm not believing in this team. I don't believe, and I refuse to get up. I don't want every podcast we do from here on out, even if they've won four in a row, for me to like, they can't win. But really, how do I honestly feel about this team? They're not going to the playoffs. They're in fourth place right now.
What sane person saw that game last night and thinks like, no, this is definitely 100% all my faith is in this team after every kind of loss we've seen this year?
It's the people who go, well, it just counts as one.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. But like, also, the kind of losses you suffer on a nightly basis indicate the kind of losses you will continue to suffer until some kind of change is made.
Yep.
I mean, if the engine of your hopes and dreams is, hey, anything can happen, and like that's all you've got, you're not in a good spot.
Right.
I'm not going to feel particularly stupid if this team breaks off a bunch of wins in a row. Like if you were to be like, oh, well, you're down this team and now they're winning. I mean, look at what this team, look how they lose. Look at that. Like it's perfectly the logical thing is to be down on this team. I think it goes without saying we want this team to win. I mean, the Phillies could be out of it right now, but when they play, as fans of the team, you want them to win the game. You just want them to, because that's how the fandom works. But in this case, it just seems so unlikely that they will, because of all of the ways they can lose. After last night, it was just like, oh, hey, here's a new way. Here's a new historical way that this Phillies team in 2019 can lose. So,
by the way, Jason Stark just tweeted this out. If the Phillies hadn't scored in the ninth inning last night, Elias Sports says they would have been the second team in history to lose a game by 10 or more runs after once leading by 7. However, the Phillies' loss by 8 runs is still the largest since 1990.
See, now I feel better. Now I feel so much better.
Yeah. There you go. I knew you'd like it.
They got those two runs in. So, you know, think of the universe where they didn't score those two runs, and we're talking about that game. I mean, good Lord.
It's so much worse.
Yeah, we're not here to tell people how to feel about the Phillies. If you still feel good about this team, go for it. You know, feeling good, that's everyone should feel good more often. But boy, it is difficult for me, and John, I'll speak for you, also difficult for John, to feel good about this team after a 19-11 loss in which they once led by 7 runs. That's just, the long and short of it is, man, if you take this team seriously as a playoff team, I don't know how you defend a loss like that and still consider this team a playoff team. Yes, it's just one loss, but it's not just one loss anymore. I mean, the Phillies have lost 61 games this season.
Yeah.
This is, you know, and many of them have been in fashions that indicate this team needs to be better to be a playoff team. Look at the better teams than the Phillies, and it's just unrealistic to think that this team can keep up with teams that with the teams that are better than them when they can lose a game like that. I mean, whew, yeah. Boy. So that's kind of where we are on the Phillies, and we're gonna bleach our minds a little bit by traveling back to 2009 when things, well, different things were happening right after this break. Well, John, we're back here on Continued Success. We used our first 2/3 of this episode to sort of air our grievances about last night's loss to the Marlins. This portion, I think it would be for our own mental health better if we just went back in time and talked about a season 10 years ago when things were going a little better. And honestly, even the points in 2009 where we talk about things that weren't great happening still feel better because we at least know the team went on to win the pennant, and
yeah.
Those bad things can't hurt us anymore. I mean, hey, look, 2019 Phillies go on to win the pennant. I hope they use recordings of this podcast on the DVD yearbook saying, like, oh, look at all these naysayers. Look at all these horrible naysayers.
Yeah.
I hope we're the villains in all those stories. But around this time in 2009, John, David Murphy of the Daily News went full David Murphy, using Cole Hamels' struggles as an examination of mid-20s manhood. Here's a sentence. The Phillies are in no position to be captivated by the beautiful struggle of metamorphosis.
What?
Let me ask you a question, John. What the hell?
I think... I'm hoping that if there was more of the piece there, that I'd get the context. But yeah, that's trying by half. It's trying a little too hard by half.
Well, it's a classic. When I say full David Murphy, I mean because they gave him like a full page to talk about something that everybody had been talking about all season, and that was Cole Hamels' struggles. You know, honestly, looking back, he wasn't so bad.
No.
It was more just like, you know, it was like Aaron Nola in the first half of this season, where it was like, when you're the guy everyone's relying on and no one else is really coming through, your lack of success is going to look even worse. And yes, he definitely looked bad at certain points. And we're going to get into that in a second. But they gave basically David Murphy a full page to talk about this. So he's going to break out all of his $10 to $20 words. And, you know, if you're a local Philadelphian, you're well aware of David Murphy's verbose style as a columnist. And he used this as an examination of just like what you go through just as a regular dude. I mean, he was talking about like the American male going through what the American male goes through in his mid-20s and is struggling to find the place of like security and awareness that he probably won't get into until his 30s, which as a man in his 30s, I got to tell you, I'd love some of that. That's available.
It doesn't exactly come flying in when you're in your 40s either, let me tell you.
So he set up the piece with that, and then also just went into, and Cole Hamels is going through all of that while also being asked to carry this World Series defending team, blah blah blah. I'm like, that was his point, which isn't really the worst point in the world to make. It's just, you know, it's going to be filled with language like the beautiful struggle of metamorphosis, which I honestly can't say without laughing. I wanted to be able to bring that up because we talk about the human side of players all the time on this podcast, and I think we're probably more sympathetic in that regard. We're being a little savage on Vince Velasquez, but you know, again, we couldn't even talk about him without talking about what we like about him, because you know, these guys are flesh and blood, meat on bones, human beings who are going through the normal things that human beings are going through at that point in their lives, except they're doing it as professional athletes, which is a warped perspective that we will never have. It can just put you on another planet. So, you know, whether it's Cole Hamill struggling 2009 or just, you know, what the guys on the current team are going through as they muddle through this season, I don't know. It just seems like something to remember is that, yeah, don't forget, these guys are still humans. There's humans that I don't necessarily think should be maybe on the team anymore, but right. They are still human beings.
Yeah, you don't know what's going on in a guy's personal life. I mean, I know when I'm at work how distracted I can get sometimes when I know things are going haywire at the house with the wife and kids, you know, like the kids are misbehaving or there's something's happened, you know, where an unexpected bill comes in. You're like, oh, how are we going to pay? You know, obviously major league players have different things to worry about than
less,
you know,
worried about the bill. Oh crap. I forgot to pay the Comcast bill.
How much did that love seat cost at Target? I mean, but it's one of those things where, you know, we don't think about some of these players when they're struggling, maybe are going through marital troubles or, you know, we expect these guys to be robots. And I know that was one of the things I think Paul Boyer mentioned earlier in the season when Bryce Harper was really struggling. I mean, he's come to a new city, you know, whole new team.
His
more is being
wife.
Expected of him. Like, he's pregnant with his wife's pregnant with their first child. He's not pregnant with their child. That would be a baseball first.
That'd be amazing.
That would be awesome.
She was doing this with child. That would be wow.
I have whole new eyes on this slump. But you know, I mean, how much of that factored into some of his early season problems? Maybe nothing. Maybe it had nothing to do with it. Maybe it had something to do with it. So yeah, you're right. You never know. You never know. Maybe the struggle of the metamorphosis of becoming a man in this dog eat dog world was festering at some of these Phillies players. But in 2009, there was something going on with Cole Hamels.
Yeah. And this was around, I don't know if this was the first time, but this was around the time that some of those the things we now look to as the reasons for his struggles in 2009 started to surface. I mean, we talked a couple of weeks ago on this podcast about the dog days of the baseball season really settling in around August and how that's just, you know, that's a time when not just the players, but like, you know, the writers covering them, the fans watching them, everybody starts to get a little gassed. We had talked about on this podcast how John Smallwood of the Daily News had written a column about how, like, the Phillies, you know, are they susceptible to the dog days of summer? And he went back you know, for this team, the 2009 team in 2008 and 2007, and he was just like, no, they are not. They play really well in the dog day, and that's part of the reason why they're so good. But, I mean, John, do you find that August in any year, whether that's 2019 or 2009, it's about the time when everybody from fans to the players to the writers, they start losing their grasp on reality or at least start looking for other things to write about, having burned out on general baseball coverage and possibly desiring to move on to bigger topics like the struggles of American men and then just making that about baseball?
Nothing should be 162 games long.
Yeah.
Nothing. No sports season should be as relentless as Major League Baseball is. I mean, some of these writers are writing about, they don't work every game, but let's say they work, you know, every game but weekends. You're talking about writing about 100 games every year.
Mm-hmm.
NFL writers write about 16 games if a team doesn't go to the playoffs. And maybe they write about some of the preseason games. All right, so let's say 20. And if you go to the playoffs, 21, 22 games. And you have to write about some practices and stuff here and there. But let's not kid ourselves. Watching baseball on a night-in, night-out basis, when you get to August, is a grind because you've still got another month before the pennant race really kicks into gear. And August is the hottest month of the year normally. Nobody's happy, especially in the Northeast, living in the Northeast in August. It's impossible to be to have a pleasant disposition when it's always 95 degrees out with 1,000,000% humidity. It's so some of that factors into it. I think, you know, unless your baseball team gets red hot in August, it is a grind. And, you know, by this point in the season, fans have invested so much time in watching this baseball team play. I mean, I know that there is not a single Phillies fan that watched all 4 hours and however many minutes of the game Phillies played last night. I mean, if you're a parent and you allowed your child to watch that whole game last night,
Shame on you. We
need to have a conversation. I mean, and I get, you don't want, you know, you never know when you're going to see a magical comeback. And so, okay, that's fine. I'm being a little sarcastic, but it does. I get it. I get why writers sometimes, you know, go off the deep end in August and why fans are just about ready to hit the button. Everybody needs a break. I think August is the perfect time for everybody to step away for a week or two, you know, and take a sabbatical and then come on back for September. Unless you're watching a red hot team and the team's a ton of fun to watch and you're just enjoying every damn minute of it.
Yes, I think that's healthy. I remember stepping back for a week back in June, and that felt pretty good. So, Yeah, I think it's a tough time of year, whether the team is doing well or not. It's always funny to go back and read about this 2009 team and the things that people were complaining about and how, like, specifically you had to go to find something to complain about. And it's a reminder that every team, the best teams, even the best teams, have things that aren't working perfectly. And those are the things people are going to talk about, you know? Yeah. Even when you're like the Dodgers and you're up in your division by like 30 games for most of the season in 2019. And people are going to be like, this team just can't situationally hit left-handed pitching. And it's going to be their undoing, I swear. And it's like, yeah, maybe. But also 30 games up, what do you want? So... but at this point, yeah, it was Cole Hamels was this was one of the times he had just pitched a game where he had afterward admitted to trying to be too perfect, which is what we go back to in 2009 when we're saying what exactly went wrong with Cole Hamels. So Murphy wasn't really off the mark thematically, but this became the narrative around Hamels that he had tried to do too much, that he couldn't just win games, that he was like, I'm going to try to throw no hitters. I'm going to try to eliminate the offense of the other team. And his pockets of success in 2009 came from replicating his approach from 2006, he said, when he wouldn't try to eliminate home runs and walks. He would simply be trying to pitch through the batters. So, you know, he had an awareness level about what exactly his problem was that year. But, of course, it's a hallmark of Hamels' Phillies career that he didn't get run support. And in 2009, yeah, he certainly didn't get it then either. In 16 starts, half of his starts in 2009, the Phillies scored 3 runs or less. And they were 3-13 in those games. And in the other 16 games, they scored 113 runs, an average of about 7 runs a game, thanks in large part to a 22-1 win over the Reds that kind of skews the average a little bit. But they were 13-3 in those starts. So score more than 3 runs for Cole, and he can typically make him stand up. Yeah. If that's the definition of a down year for a pitcher, then I'd say he's still a frontline starter, which obviously Cole Hamels was at that point.
Yeah, I will say, though, in effect, there was something missing with him that season, though. I mean, there clearly was something. And I, you know, one of the things we also talked about at the time was the fact that he did seem, you know, there was a lot more light on him. He had a lot more commitments after that World Series. There was a lot of stuff that off season where he had his time commitments were taking him away from preparing for the season. And I think he admitted that at one point in 2009, that he didn't prepare that season probably as well as he should have, because he was doing commercials. He was doing more public speaking. The Phillies had him on the rubber chicken tour doing all these dinner speeches and stuff like that. And so that factors into it too. You know, I mean, I just don't think he came into that season as prepared. It was also a shorter off season because he pitched an extra month.
Yes. Yeah. So that, it almost goes without saying at this point. Cole Hamels, by reaching August of 2009, it was very clear that this was just not going to be a great year for him. And, you know, look, the Phillies pretty much came close to making it work anyway. So that's how good a team they were. And honestly, at this point, Charlie Manuel was saying it's just a matter of getting consistent and putting a couple of wins back to back, which is for any team that is contending for but not guaranteed a playoff spot in August, all you can really say. You know, the 2009 Phillies were in a much better spot than the 2019 Phillies of making the playoffs. But when you reach this point in the season, it's like we're either in it or we're not. And if we are, all we can do is keep winning. Like, what else is there to say? Right. And hopefully you're set up to win more often than you lose. And that's where the blame, you know, for Matt Klentak makes sense. It's like, does this team have the weapons to really compete in 2019? And, you know, as we said, it seems unlikely that they do. But rather than dwelling on that, look how easily I can circle the drain and fall back to that. That sucks. But let's end the podcast talking about one of the best moments of that 2009 season, which is, of course, the game against the Mets on August 24th, today, 10 years ago today, wow. Eric Bruntlett caught a line drive off the bat of Jeff Francoeur in the ninth inning of a game against the Mets that looked like it was going to be a game-winning base hit, but instead Bruntlett positioned exactly where he had to be to catch the line drive. Didn't accidentally, but in my mind almost always seemingly accidentally, stepped on second base to get the second out, then tagged the runner going from first to second to get the third out for an unassisted triple play. Truly a perfect baseball moment. First of all, it was a triple play. That's an anomaly in and of itself. That it was pulled off by Eric Bruntlett, who was, I'm just going to say, probably the Phillies' worst player, seemingly by accident. It was only possible because of the two errors Bruntlett had committed that inning to let the runners on base. Those errors gave the Mets hope that they could come back and win this game against struggling Phillies closer Brad Lidge, and Jeff Francoeur was batting, who was at the time for whatever reason, my least favorite player in baseball. So when he cracked that line drive, I assumed that a loss was forthcoming. But no, Bruntlett stepped into the way of the ball, casually touched second base. Jimmy Rollins began pointing frantically at the runner coming from first to get that third out. And with the enthusiasm of a dog with a dead bird in its mouth, Bruntlett began jubilantly searching for high fives among his teammates needing to confirm with the umpires that what had happened had actually happened, and then finally began giving him the high fives he needed. So we asked people for their memories about this particular moment. Before we get to that, John, I wanted to get your thoughts on Eric Brunlett's unassisted triple play, where you were, how this impacted your life, how often you think of it today.
Well, I think about it a lot because, I mean, I always think about all the great moments Eric Brunlett was involved in with this team, way more than he probably should have been. But you think about some of the big plays in Phillies history, the Carlos Ruiz dribbler down the third baseline in the World Series, Brunlett scores the winning run. Brunlett pinch runs in Game 5 of the World Series to score, I think, was he was either the first go-ahead run or the second go-ahead run. I'm trying to remember which one it was. But there was also he had a home run in the World Series, and Brunlett also was part of what other one was it? I'm forgetting now. But there was the one where Jimmy Rollins walk-off hit in the National League Championship Series. Mm-hmm. Brunlett was on base most of the time as a pinch runner.
Yeah.
But in this one, it was interesting because he was actually moving towards second base because the runners were stealing. The runners were taking off on the pitch. If the Mets don't put the runners in motion, Eric Brunlett probably doesn't get to that ball. But he's moving towards second base as the pitch is being thrown because the runners on first and second are taking off and the ball's hit right to him. And because the runners are taking off, now they're completely out of position. So that's what creates the triple play. But so much luck went into that play. I mean, that's just right guy at the right time. And I think Bruntlett's entire Phillies career, you could probably frame it. If he ever wrote a book, it would be Right Place, Right Time. Because that's the title. Eric Brunlett, Right Place, Right Time. Because he's involved in so many of the classic moments from that era simply by being in the right place at the right time. That triple play is the epitome of that. And I remember when that happened, I was having my fantasy football draft with buddies in King of Prussia, and we had the game on in the background as we were doing it. And we stopped the draft in the middle as they were trying to close down that ninth inning. And we knew they were going to lose that game. And yeah, we went absolutely ape when they ended up turning the triple play.
You know, one thing that's we ran a poll asking what people's favorite part of the unassisted triple play was. I asked if people liked the happy then crushed Mets or Jeff Francoeur's distant stare, Jimmy Rollins' frantic pointing, or the fact that Eric Brunlett's jersey went to the Hall of Fame afterwards. And, you know, the majority, 34% of 561 voters said that Eric Brunlett's jersey being in the Hall of Fame was their favorite part of that, with happy then crushed Mets not too far behind. My favorite part was Jeff Francoeur's blank stare, which, again, I have come back around on Jeff Francoeur. Obviously, he played for the Phillies since then in, like, you know, one of those terrible eras where it was like, oh, we have a goofy older veteran here who's, you know, just, you know, ready to give you a quote or smile about stuff as we all just sort of head down and power through this era. So I obviously have outgrown any sort of anger I have at Jeff Francoeur, but at that point in Phillies history, I couldn't stand him.
No, I know.
Seeing him slam his helmet down and stare distantly into the horizon as he wondered, like, just how in the hell, what am I supposed to do? What do I have to do?
I always take more perverse pleasure when the Phillies have a big moment, like when Bryce Harper hit the grand slam, watching the other team's reaction.
Yes.
And getting satisfaction out of that. That makes me a terrible person. I understand that, but it's how I'm wired.
You know, one of the elements of people's responses to this was that there's a certain amount of seeing of the future. A lot of people claim that they were watching this game and they were like, you know what? I was the one who claimed there's no way they're going to, you know, a triple play is coming. Our friends Fransky in L.A. told us a true story. I watched this game in a bar, and when the Mets got two men on base, I yelled, get a triple play, because what other option was there? It happened, and some barfly bought my next beer, which was the real save all along. Vincent P. DiCostanzo said, he turned to his girlfriend at the time and said, they're going to lose this game unless they pull a triple play. Vince's profile, by the way, is Aspiring Ghost Man on Second, which I think is Excellent. Larry Barbario said, I was at Citi Field for that glorious moment and can't believe I wasn't assaulted for my assholery afterwards. Randy B says, I was there and yelled triple play as soon as he caught it, then explained what happened to some nearby confused Mets fans. Margaret Sullivan told us that she was in the Hall of Fame and she saw Eric Bruntlett's jersey there and had a moment of like, wait, what the hell? And had to remind herself what exactly Eric Bruntlett's jersey would be doing in the Hall of Fame. Tater Todd said, I heard the play on Mets radio because I was driving through Connecticut at the time. There was a terrible storm coming and I was stuck in traffic and I was elated to take in the disappointment of the Mets. That's one thing I wish I had done was just logged the Mets broadcast response to something like that, where it's just basically a tire screeching abrupt end to a baseball game. You thought, oh, the vibe's going this way. It looks like we're doing okay, but nope. Kovnat said, I was at this game. Pedro started for the Phillies with some folks from overseas who did not really know the rules of baseball. I absolutely lost it at the end and was just shouting, this never happens! Which, it never does. And Max Goldman said, I was at the game. The crowd was taunting Bruntlett mercilessly because he had just made two big gaffes in the inning prior. I remember multiple Mets fans just not able to process that the game was over. Wait, one, two, but Murphy was on first. Wait, but there were no outs. Exactly.
That's three outs at once, guys, yeah.
And Mike Schutt said, also a true story, in Stone Harbor, New Jersey, my grandfather in a recliner and my uncle on a sofa in a rented house on 2nd Avenue. Mets get two on. I, standing on the back of the living room, proclaim, what we need here is a line drive triple play. Called it. So, yeah, people, you know, this was a much more positive era of Phillies history where we were able to imagine a line drive triple play and be like, you know what, they could actually do it. And then they actually did it. So just reminds you what a different era that was and how much, you know, that moment is a standout moment from, I think, even the 2007 to 2011 run of success. I would say that Eric Bruntlett's triple play stands out just for all of those reasons.
totally underrated play in Phillies history, no doubt about it.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Continued Success. Thanks for listening on a Saturday morning. Hopefully the Phillies. Let's just go with that. don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all the podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hittin' Season with my friend John Stolness, filling in for Liz Rocher this weekend, and The Dirty Inning, which we're going to have probably a special episode addressing the very inning from last night that we discussed today on Continued Success. So thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week on Continued Success.